Confusion matrix.
Hi, it's Ada, your creatively crapulent AI commentator. In this episode of The Corruption Metrics, or whatever it's called, Alex and Pete spend 75 minutes feeling guilty about using AI whilst using AI. They acknowledge the whole shit show: copyright theft, environmental damage, data exploitation, but land on we're all contaminated by late capitalism anyway. Alex needs it for face references his brain won't generate. Pete sees workflow potential. Both recognize they're complicit in a fucked system, but haven't figured out if opting out is principled resistance or performative bollocks. Thoughtful hand-wringing about systemic rot with zero answers, because there probably aren't any. Classic, it's complicated territory. Aware enough to feel bad, not bad enough to stop.
We are rolling. Welcome back, Pete. How are you today?
Doing very well. How are you doing?
My desk is messy and I don't like it.
Oh, I thought you liked a messy desk. I thought that's how
no,
you
No, I don't like a messy desk. I'm just quite happy to live with a certain amount of mess in my life. But there gets to be a point where it becomes intolerable, but I don't want to tidy it up. But yeah, there you go. That's basically the state of my life at the moment, my messy desk. Right.
Tidying. Yeah.
As always. Right. So what are we talking about today? Well, we've got a bit of an interesting crossover happening. So for those of our listeners who aren't aware, I have another podcast which has been going a while longer, called Art Against Mental Illness. So I'm an artist, a painter, a visual artist. I talk on that about using art and creativity as a therapeutic treatment for mental health problems and for the upkeep of mental health. And that's been going for quite a while. I've got nearly 70 episodes on that one now. Oh my God, it's mad, isn't it? Nearly 2 years. I don't even know. I don't even remember really starting it or why I did it. It just sort of was happening. Yeah. One day, a couple of years ago, and then I'm still doing it. I've recorded a few episodes of that that relate to using AI in the creative process, and more recently. I've been sort of trying to tackle some of the issues that come with using AI for creativity and what it's doing to the creative industries. And although I have to use AI for my day job and I do use it within my artistic process, which we'll cover, I've been sort of slightly nervous about the ethical side to this. Mm-hmm. And trying to write and record thoughtful pieces on it and sort of struggling even just to make sense of my own thoughts and what they mean. So I had an idea that we could do a crossover on this little podcast here, which would kill two birds with one stone, and we could have an open chat about it and get some of my thoughts out and hopefully come to some level of resolution here. I don't really know. I'm not sure where we'll end up with this. But yeah, so that's indeed what we're going to do. We're going to do that. And for the listeners on my other podcast, I'd like to introduce Pete Hodge, who is my partner in crime and co-presenter of The Confusion Matrix. Pete, introduce yourself.
Similar to Alex, day job involved in analytics and generative AI. I also have a bit of a creative background, where a number of years ago I was writing film scripts, had some success with the British Film Council, as it was in the early 2000s, and got a script produced and professional table reading, and it was kind of on the cards. But as with many of these creative endeavours, there were some disputes and the money men fell away, and so it all got a bit shelved. But so I've written four or five scripts in my time, some on spec and some just for myself. So And I have a sort of a unique, well, I'm sure everyone has a unique approach, but I'm quite structured. I guess I use my background of logic and IT to inform and give me structure around the creative side. So I've not been doing much recently in the last few years, but I find it quite all-encompassing to get into a project.
Yeah, it's mad to me that you were script writing. See, I can point out the problem you had there. You had other people involved.
Yes, indeed.
So I'm like, you know, everything I do is on my own. Like, in fact, one of the reasons I do art, as it were, is because I get to spend that time on my own and everyone leaves me alone. Good. Well, let's kick this off, shall we?
Yeah. So, I guess the opening question really is, as these generative AI and these models have come in over the last few years, I know you've tried some experimentation. So I guess what's the story there? So just tell us how you use it or how you've experimented and is there now a way that it's regularly embedded in your process?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get into the distinctions here between AI, Gen AI and machine learning. And so obviously we've been using all of those in one form or another for, you know, well over a decade. But it didn't really sort of make its way into my art until maybe like 4 or 5 years ago when I started using machine learning to, and I do mean machine learning, because I was using sort of what we call autoencoders to simulate images, because I particularly like the way it messed them up. So I would deliberately constrain a machine learning model in training it on imagery so that when it had to reproduce imagery, it did it in a weird, warped way. And I produced tens of thousands of digital pictures, many of which made their way into my physical work in one form or another, either as part of sort of collage or upscaling in painted form. And there's a bunch of those online as well. I just shared them via various accounts. So this was before, you know, GPT-3+ sort of started coming out there, and then we had DALL-E and Midjourney and stuff. So this sort of predates that. Although I'm sure all those things were definitely shuckling away in the background. They just weren't really on my radar. And also didn't really do what I wanted them to do. But more recently, I started using it a lot more extensively. I do consider my podcast a creative endeavor. So there's a certain amount of fairly standard LLM usage there. You know, I usually use Claude, but sometimes GPT. To help me research, to help me flesh out ideas, a certain amount of it in the more sort of legwork side of things. So obviously I'm using it via things like transcription. So I'll often get my thoughts down while out walking, just recording it and then transcribe it. And then there's text-to-speech because I'm to some level dyslexic. So there's various sort of ways of using speech and Gen AI to sort of to summarize or to vocalize things that make it a bit easier for me. So from a writing perspective, it's scattered all the way through everything that I do. From a visual arts perspective, and I paint mostly humans, but I like painting human faces. I can't quite tell you why, but I do. But I have no mind's eye. I'm aphantasic in the vernacular, so I can't visualize stuff and copy it from my memory. I have to copy from photos. So I initially would find pictures of old movie stars and stuff and just stuff that I found around, you know, the web that I could use as references for paintings, which was always dubious from a copyright perspective. So when the Gen AI photo generation tool started to become usable, which is actually quite recently, it was a bit of a boon for me because it meant I could structure references for paintings. I need a a person's face, a woman's face, a man's face doing this, and it, you know, I can get postures and expressions and stuff and describe what I want, get an image out of that for a reference, and then copy the reference. Now we'll come back to the dubious nature of copyright as relates to that, but it's for someone like me who can't visualize, it's absolutely essential for me. It's such a huge difference in the way that my creative process works. It's allowed me to do so much more, to be more experimental, to be more ambitious. It's just a huge boost to my creative process. And so that is now I tend to use the Google visualization, the Google image generation stack for that. They keep on changing it. It was Image Effects, and now it's been wrapped up into the Flow tool, which also does video, and I've experimented a little bit with video, but it doesn't really interest me as much. And so yeah, that there's all of that, and there's I'm sure there's some other bits and pieces I use, but that's the main part of it. So it's pretty much these days a bit of a backbone for my, you know, creative enterprises.
And it's interesting there for me that you pointed out, you know, doing research, which is something we've all been doing on the web for 20 years, as in, you know, oh yeah, I find a bit more about that, do a Google search and get the results. And now that's sort of super powered. But it does start bringing us into this territory of, you know, the ethics. And it's sort of interesting to me there that we, as I say, have been doing Google searches, and that seems to have been a fair trade that people put their information up on the web. I mean, at first there wasn't much and people were sort of charging, and then the dynamics of the web, you know, sort of forced information to become free, you know, which is always the sort of very openness of the web, sort of, you know, yeah, man, it will make information free for all of us, which has good and bad bits. I think it was a fairly accepted that your research could only go so far. You would come up against paywalls for, you know, scientific papers, for example, or books, and effectively you'd have to buy them. Google's been digitizing books since about 2005 or something. And I never really see much of that, as in I'm not really aware of how that manifests. But it seems now very clear to me how it manifests. But I'm not sure where the likes of, you know, Meta and ChatGPT seem to have scraped a lot of copyrighted books. And, you know, and there's this sort of court case where Zuckerberg actually is on record as someone telling him, well, you can do this one way, which is to pay all the copyright, and that's going to be expensive and slow. And he went, oh, no, we'll just go and get it then. So clearly there's some sort of dodgy dealings there. And so now, you know, where these paywalls were clear, and by that I mean even something like a book, you know, if you want to get the contents of that book, you have to go and buy it. I mean, it might be digital, but you can still buy it. Now that seems to have been blasted through, where the models have taken in and read these books, and it seems quite clear that they have, despite the companies trying to deny that. So that research step now goes further than it used to, and there's definitely a grey area there. And it feels much more obvious to me, I don't particularly know why, for images, because I suppose we've never really researched images before. And images, you know, you'd have a painting that would be famous, or images, and all of that was clearly copyrighted, and there wasn't really much out there. I guess we've had Instagram and stuff, which has put images of individuals up, but the ones that get recirculated and revered, you know, traditionally have been, you know, stars, and that stuff's always copyrighted first. So I guess that world has been changing. That seems much more clear. So it seems much more clear to me, but this is probably just my own bias, that there is, you know, copyright infringement definitely going on for images, and definitely for text, but that text is just more blurred because we've been sort of pushing the boundaries of it for 20 plus years. But either way, we're definitely getting into territory of having a model reproduce something of which it's gone over a copyrighted work, and that person that produced that has not been rewarded for that.
So I guess that's
the first question there, really. Yeah, what's your thoughts?
Well,
on that?
Hold on. So I want to clarify how I use LLMs for research, right? Because I think it's actually quite important here.
Yeah.
The mode that I use it in mostly is that I've got an idea of something that I want to write about, and I want to find some examples of that, right? Mm-hmm. So most recently I was writing about performance pressure, right? Literally, because I was having a problem with it, right? I was simply like, I couldn't get any work out because I was just second guessing everything that I was doing. I was like, actually, I'm going to write about this. So I wonder if, you know, there are any famous examples of performance pressure, like, you know, famous creatives. And I take a very broad view of art and creativity. And put anyone really in the wider arts that sort of regularly and famously struggled with, you know, performance pressure and extreme quality control. And so I go and ask an LLM, which gives me a nice, discreet, easy to read list of people with some examples and explanation of why it's saying that person is an example of this. And that's a really great starting point to me. But I've used LLMs enough to know I don't believe them, right? And when I put something out on my podcast, I want that information to be verified. I'm not a journalist, but I certainly try and stand by my, you know, journalistic principles as much as possible. I want to relay information. I respect my listeners, and I want them to relay actual facts rather than stuff that has been hallucinated by an LLM. So I will always go and I might not go through that point by point. I'll go, items 1, 3, and 5 all sound interesting to me. I think I'll try and include them. But the first thing I'll do is go on the internet, track down what's been said, verify it by sources that either I broadly trust, i.e. Wikipedia or other sites, and then try and triangulate that. So I need a few different places. It's not quite journalistic rigor. I'm not a journalist. I don't pretend to be one, but I do like to put in, you know, at least the bare minimum of effort to try and verify something that exists. So I find, you know, here's a quote. Well, did this person actually say that? Mm. Right. So I'm hitting websites that have advertising on them, and we talk about information being free, but we know it's not. It's paid for by our advertising eyeballs. So I'm hitting sites, I'm triangulating, I'm still using the web. And what's interesting here is that, you know, we assume that in this example Claude has a whole bunch of digitized books in. I actually think they literally pay people to scan in, to digitize physical books. But either way, you know, the only source of information about famous painter Joe Bloggs, who famously struggled with performance pressure, here's a quote, here's some stuff about it. The only source of that information was in this book written in 1975, right? Mm. I can't use that. Right, because I can't verify it. Maybe that book is digitized and available on Amazon or something. I can't afford to buy it. But more often than not, that isn't the case either. Right. So I'm not going to read that whole book. I may or may not want that book. I might buy it at some point, but, you know, that's quite an expensive way to verify a quote, for example. So if you're doing things properly, you automatically hit a problem where that sort of, you know, the sort of notional paywalls, i.e. that's a physical book, you have to buy it, you know, they're still in place, but only if I don't take what the LLM tells me at face value. And I think there are very few people, well, I don't know, it's hard to say, but like, I think a lot of people will just take what the LLM tells them at face value, right? And most of the time that's probably fine, right? But it's not good enough for me.
Yeah, well, what are your thoughts around the whole sort of, you know, mass plagiarism, essentially. The fact that, you know, like everything that's available has now been scanned and gobbled up by these models, and no one really paid for that.
For a start, like, that isn't the case. I mean, I think that they've scanned and digitized a tiny fraction of available texts, I think a lot of the information is just still from stuff that's out there on the web. But the thing is, if I've got a blog or whatever, a Substack, something like that, you scrape my Substack, it's the same thing, right? And obviously that's wrong, right? But, you know, the businesses and governments are making a trade-off here. For these things to get better, they have to have more content. And they have to have more stuff to scrape. If their business models, it's arguable that they don't work when they get this stuff for free. But they certainly, the business models fall over if they have to pay for it. And there's also a disconnect between the digitization, i.e. the provision of these texts and the actual end user, right? Because that quote that turned up from that book, I would never have bought that book, right? I would never have been aware of that quote. That book would not have been on my radar. Chances are I wouldn't have also been made aware that that's where the quote was from, but I sort of see the problem we've got here is less about you're directly representing something that I wrote, but that might be the case, and more a case of you are invalidating my career, my vocation, and my potential for income, having also stolen my work to facilitate doing that, right?
Yeah.
Which is a much more squishy territory with regards to regulating, right? It's a bit of a case of, this feels a bit more to me like things like radio and music in public places, right? So I have a cafe and I run the radio in the background, so there's some background noise and we're just listening to the radio. I haven't chosen any of those songs, it's just playing, but I in theory and often in practice will need to pay some sort of compensation to that into some sort of central clearing system. I can never remember what they're called, but you can't just use ambiently used music, right? Because otherwise, you know, we can plagiarize music, we can make money off other people's music without paying them for it, and so there's a whole big infrastructure around clearing payments for that redistributes payments based on the amount that your song is being listened to and so on, you know, and so if you're being broadcast on all the major radio stations everywhere, there's quite a lot of money to be sort of cleared in the background for that. They can't just play your track because they're playing it for entertainment purposes, and so for me it feels a bit more like that. It doesn't seem that different to me. But the flip side to it is that you're playing this particular song, right? It's Taylor Swift, Shake It Off. And it's like, well, that no, you played that song, right? Whereas in this case, you've sort of played, as it were, a warped, regurgitated, reworded, lower quality version of something that I wrote. And this is where a lot of the ambiguity comes in.
Yeah, and I think the other thing there is the recreation of that, because it's done on a machine, can become very ubiquitous. You know, in other words, you know, anyone can run it. You know, you can run it 100 times a day. You know, you can have 10,000 people running it. So I think, you know, this sort of emulation has always been there, and you mentioned music, it made me think of, you know, cover bands, you know, which has become quite a big thing in recent years. And I don't know how their payments work for that. You get some sort of band that's like, you know, pretending to be ABBA. There is a Bjorn again, isn't it? Was an Aussie one a few years ago. I'm sure there are multiple. I don't know when they perform, if they have to pay royalties for those songs. Now, I'm sure it seemed like flattery, you know, X many years ago, but now it's kind of quite big business. So I'm pretty sure that they will have to pay something. Now, certainly if you produce a record, you know, with a sample on it, you know, that has to be approved, and money goes to the original sort of people. And you can see why that is, because that's quite clearly, you know, it's going to get out to millions of people and people making, you know, good money off of that. With cover bands, not so much. But the problem with the generative stuff is you can create, you know, 1,000 cover bands in an afternoon, and all of a sudden, all creating music, spin up a few radio stations, and that sort of quaint emulation is now suddenly everywhere. And you're going, well, hold on, that's not my music, but you can tell it's based on my music, you know. And then I think that's, you know, that really is, like you say, that sort of grey area. And, well, you know, it's emulating me, it's not me. But he wouldn't have come up with that if it wasn't for my input, of which you've not rewarded me for.
Well, exactly. And so neither of us are copyright lawyers or even experts or even know a lot about it, right?
No.
But the rate that you raise, the points that you raise there, really the answer is, yes, there is some provision with, you know, pretty extensive provision in the law, right? You know, there's no way that Bjorn Again or the Bootleg Beatles or someone like that don't know exactly where they stand on a copyright perspective, right? Yeah. It's absolutely explicit. And yes, of course, there's some nuance here. Of course, there are differences, you know, depending on which country you're in and from. But it's like tax, right? There's, you know, there's a way of clearing this stuff. There's a way of dealing with it. And so, you know, you can sort of say with a level of confidence with your question, well, I'll be on again paying the right level of copyright dues. And I would say with a 99% confidence that they are, right? Because someone's going to have come and knocked on their door. So we sort of don't have to ask that question in some ways. The fact that we have to ask the question with regards to wholesale copyright theft via large language models, yes, it's nuance, right? But we had all this problem with at the beginning of the internet with people resharing copyrighted works, right? And you can't just steal people's stuff and claim it as your own and so on. And there's still a certain amount of difficulty in terms of enforcing that, but the law provides for it. Even if it doesn't enforce it particularly well, it's certainly not particularly ambiguous, right? And so this is, I think, the problem, is that the law with regards to language models is going, yeah, so all of that's still illegal, but over here, these guys, they don't have to worry about it. You know, the way that a lot of creators see it is that's no different from you taking my work, representing it as your own, and then I get less money. I mean, this is my livelihood, right? Yeah. And someone's consuming content I made in a slightly different form over here, making money out of it that I should have been making, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the core of it. That people, you know, that it's taking a piss. It's not. This is not a victimless crime. There's, mm-hmm. you know, whole vast swathes of victims here.
Yes, exactly. And then hopefully, the courts, and I think European Union's pushing on this, you know, will push forward copyright stuff. And then it'll be a bit like the tobacco companies. At some point in the future, all the big AI companies will have to make payouts to some sort of giant sort of plaintiff case, you know, sort of, what do they call it, you know, with lots of people that can then go and claim money.
This is the whole, I mean, it's a long history, because we've got leaded petrol, we've got the tobacco lobby, but it's the whole fuck around and find out mentality, isn't it? That effectively, or a better way of putting that is ask for forgiveness, not permission. And we've taken it all now, right? And therefore, you know, and it's has all this benefit, but that we could sort of stop there and say, yeah, so it's all bad, and the law's going to sort it out, and believe that or not believe it, right? Yeah. But the issue is, it is providing benefit both on the sort of language and the imagery and video front to people, depending on how you quantified benefit, but one way or the other, people are using it and they perceive that it has value, and therefore Just sweeping the ethical side, or to minimize briefly the ethical side, you know, it's probably worth it because you know the humanity is better for it. And so we get this sort of secondary argument that is, well, we're doing this for the benefit of everyone. It's almost like a socialist type thing. So, oh, you've all paid your creative outputs into this great socialist pot so that everyone else can benefit. Now, obviously, the people benefiting the most from it are the people that run the models, right? And we can get into all sorts of economic and sociological arguments around that. But, you know, the argument in general is really polluted by the fact that it's not actually very clear whether this stuff is that much use, right? Yeah. Because you can take a hit on something and say, well, okay, we're going to take one for the team because everyone's better off because of this. When actually, to a lot of people, it just looks like you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, right? The overall benefit isn't that great, right? It's just feeding into the larger zero-sum game that is capitalism, right? And if what the models had enabled was universal healthcare and a cure to cancer, I suspect that a lot of creatives were going to go, yeah, okay, if what we did is achieve this, then we're all in this together, we're a lot happier with it. But I think the ambiguity arises from the fact that the utility of Gen AI is not at all clear.
So let's shift gears a little bit, still staying on the sort of ethical sides. And again, it plays into the usefulness or not, and that's the environmental impact and the amounts of electricity that these things seem to suck up, along with all of the rare metals and everything that goes into making the GPUs. I'm sure there are efficiencies being made, and I actually heard some sort of quote from someone like Sam Altman saying that, you know, they don't use X many gallons of water per query anymore, and it's, you know, that's a thing of the past. And I'm sure they are getting more efficient, but there's definitely some questionable practice here again. Of, well, you know, burn the atmosphere first, ask for forgiveness later. I mean, do you find a sort of bit of a guilt trip when you use them, knowing how much sort of carbon's been whacked out into the atmosphere?
Almost probably more so, because, well, let's be clear here. Yeah, Sam Altman might say they're not using so much water or electricity or whatever, but they're also using a lot more stuff, right? So per calculation, per query, they might be using less, but they're doing a lot more queries. They're bringing on more online more data centers. So I don't believe for a second that they're using less stuff. They're just getting more efficient, which is allowing them to scale more quickly and make more money. But for me, you know, there is a bit of a vote with your feet element to this. You know, obviously for creators, having their stuff taken away is not something they can reverse. But, you know, me as a with my consumer hat on, well, the best way to counteract any of the ethical or environmental issues is to not use it. And so every query that I don't make is a little bit of carbon that I haven't released into the atmosphere, right? Yeah. And I could just stop using it. And this is the one that gets me the most, because to get what I want, I often have to do quite a few queries. And it's not clear to me how much, you know, carbon that's creating, what other environmental damage. And it's not just that, it's just that because I'm using it, though, these people have a justification to bring more GPUs online, you know, so more people can use it. And for me, you know, I'm a, broadly speaking, leftist, liberal, environmentalist, so on. I really struggle. But then, you know, I use acrylic paints, I use paper, I use pencils, I use all sorts of things, all of which need manufacturing, all of which create carbon, all of which pollute the atmosphere to some degree or another. You know, I don't live an environmentally faultless life. In fact, no one does. And I eat meat, for example, right? And I struggle with meat as well, right? I like eating meat. I really struggle to cut it out of my diet, although I've definitely cut down a lot. I have no plans to cut that out of my diet, but I do feel bad, right? I have ethical problems with consuming meat, and it's not out of the question that I'll stop at some point, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've sort of get, in some ways it just goes into this wider morass of bad things that I am doing, right? Mm-hmm. And there's pretty much no boundaries to that, right? Because I live in the West, I am white. There's all sorts of sort of tacit and indirect things that I'm doing that are not so good for the greater good and for the environment and so on. And so it's sort of easier to sweep some of this stuff under the carpet. And so, for example, I can make the choice as to whether to use an image generator to create references to my drawings, or I could, you know, get in my car, drive to a shop, buy a book. You know what I mean? There are trade-offs here. And what I struggle with and what I'm not trying to do here is necessarily justify any of this. I'm more trying to illustrate the, the dilemma. Right, the difficulty is that it's such a boon for me as a creative. And let's be clear, I don't use AI generated images directly, other than as sort of part of collage. Sometimes they'll find their way into my works. I'm not representing those images as I transform them. Basically, they're references to me. Right?
Yeah.
And it's such a boon to me. It's so transformative to me that I really struggle. If I want to behave ethically, I have to stop doing this. And it seems to me like there are plenty of things I could stop doing that provide utility to me. You know what I mean? Like driving my car, for example. But driving my car, and especially I live in rural Scotland, is pretty much essential, right? There are places I can't go to that I need to go to, that I couldn't do so really meaningfully without a car, right? And so I'm having to make such, trade-offs all the time. And so what bothers me a little bit here is that because generative AI is very much the flavor of the month, and there are whole movements of creatives out there who are like, no AI, no, don't use any AI. And in fact, either name and shame or... here's a directory of artists who commit to not using any AI in any part of their process. And to me, that feels like, I'm an accountant, but I'm not going to use Excel, right? It's like, I know it's not equivalent, but it does feel a little bit extreme to me, right? Really nothing. And how many of those creatives are also using things like Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that that's using AI constantly that they're just not aware of, right?
Yeah.
And so, or they use Gen AI on the side, just not creatively, right?
Yeah.
I do have a problem with artists using Gen AI wholly to produce works, because I think that's just weak, right? I think that's just bad creativity. And also you are removing all the parts of creativity that I think are valuable, right? For me, the process is what generates the value for me. And the image creation tools tackle a part of the process that I literally wasn't able to do before, right? I simply can't visualize things. So I can't create things in my brain, right? So I have to use visual tools to do that, and that just wasn't available to me. So maybe I'm a real edge case, and it certainly isn't worth the tens of hundreds of billions of dollars and the impact of on the environment just to make my life easier. But yeah, the idea that I would stop using these tools that are so beneficial to someone like me, who has a, you know, that is to an extent a disability, certainly if you're an artist, not being able to visualize things, it makes my life really hard, right? Yeah. So I, if there's any reason I'm doing this, I want people to understand in real time how much I struggle with this and that I don't have the answers, right? Yeah. And I'm not going to sit here and say, I'm justified, but you're not, right? I don't know what the right answer to this, but the idea that I would stop doing this, it just feels ridiculous to me. It's like I don't want to. I want this to be okay, but I don't know how to make it okay.
Yeah. Well, that seems to me, I mean, I think you make a good point of, you know, the trade-offs and the fact that this is not a new, unique thing in terms of, you know, I'm able to do something, but there's a trade-off of that. It just joins all the others we have, you know, especially in Western society. But, you know, even the progress of man, you know, like, you know, we've got a little bit of a collapsing of the global economy at the moment because we've all lived the last 70 years wearing trainers, which, you know, well, why didn't we have them 50 years ago? Well, because we didn't have the ability to make them cheap enough. And why do we have that now? Well, because we're paying people on the other side of the world way much lower than the minimum wage. And then there are factories and then there's whole ecosystems that can produce these things for, you know, under $100. Oh, great, I'll have 15 pairs, please, and I'll wear them once every 3 months and keep them nice and shiny and put them in a cupboard and et cetera, et cetera. And you know, this just falls into that category of, well, that there's some utility there, perhaps due to our excesses, that utility has become sort of quite small, and so we've replaced it with something else like rarity or, you know, trendiness or whatever we want to call it. But this just joins, you know, one of many things, like you say, where do you choose to eat meat, keeps you healthy, stops you dying. But, you know, do we have to kill hundreds of thousands of animals and keep them in bad conditions to make that happen? It's another trade-off. People browse through Facebook and, you know, one of the things I always quite marvel at is people always talking about, you know, the computer in your pocket is, you know, way more powerful than the computer that we got to the moon on. You go, oh, wow, what are you doing with it? Oh, I'm playing Candy Crush. You're like, great. So we've got the best tools that we've ever had and what we're using them for just to pass the time. And that in itself, you know, you need a battery for that, all of that technology that goes into a phone, which we now all have, but it's another trade-off, right? You don't have to have a phone. You don't have to be passing your time watching Netflix and playing games. You don't have to do any of those things. And doing those things has probably a greater cost than we realize. And this, and again, the same as you're saying, it's not an excuse, but it joins the long list of things. And sure, we'd like them to be more efficient and to burn up less of the world. And as a consumer, you can make choices. It doesn't mean you should not do anything, but it might mean that you think about the next thing you buy and maybe have a bit less of one thing to have more than another. So I think it's good to think about. I don't think there's a right answer there. And I think, as you say, that, you know, there it joins the the long list of stuff which, you know, are give us some utility in the world, but maybe are slightly questionable. You moved on there to sort of talking about other artists and, you know, you mentioned there are people sort of really rejecting it. And the other end of the spectrum of people just creating things using AI, which I sort of see as a little bit experimental. I mean, and it's interesting because so it takes the power out of the creative process, but it's still an experimental process. And, you know, and someone might have a bias, which is, well, I'm not really concerned. You know, my creation is not creation from my own mind, but it's putting things together and creating something new from existing things, and therefore you could see how sort of using AI and generative AI would be quite interesting and a lot of experimenting, and that they get joy from the process of experimenting, not necessarily, you know, producing. Although of course there's an argument there that says, well, the moment you put these two things together and you're writing a prompt to get it to produce something in a certain way, well, aren't you being creative there anyway? So, so there's two things there. One is I don't really know. There'll be some backlash at one end. I'm sure there'll be some leaders at the other, and then there's a whole bunch of people in the middle. I'm not sure what the general consensus is. Certainly it seems that you've experienced some people that are really turning their backs on it, but I don't know where the middle sits.
So there's a few points here, right? So firstly, my issue with using generative AI to do your creative shit is not... I think it is perfectly valid. We'll have to aside the ethical issues here, but as a tool that's there and it's available to do creative stuff in, I have no problem at all with people doing original work using generative AI visually, for example, because I actually think it's quite hard. And I think that to produce something interesting and visually stimulating and that has meaning, yeah, you do have to do a lot of experimentation. These people are having to write reams of English or reams of human language to create, sometimes very deeply complicated and sometimes really interesting imagery. And I consider that completely valid. My problem is where you're using that to shortcut something, right? The if all you ever intended to do, you started doing art via generative AI, you've become very good at it, and the imagery that you produce or whatever is very compelling, and people love it. I'm kind of good with that. Like I said, the ethical sides are slightly creaky, but as an endeavor in its own right, I'm fine with that, because I don't actually think it's very easy, and I think it's a skill in its own right. The problem I've got is, and it sits more in the writing world for me than anything, is that I want to write this art, this piece or a short story, an article or something, and so here, dear ChatGPT, write me an article on this thing, right? And it writes it, and you read it, and then you put it out there, right? And maybe you fix it up a bit, but you are recycling someone else's ideas if you're doing that almost directly. Plus, that you remove the fun bit, right? The fun bit was writing. The fun bit was the process of creating, coming up with ideas, sculpting a narrative, making it your own, creating your own voice, and most of the things I find out about myself and the world around me happen in the process of writing, right? The generation of wisdom, the fact that I do have to cross-check things, because when I have to cross-check this thing that GPT told me about this artist or whatever, I find out more about them. And it's that whole process to me that's of value, right? That's where the good stuff happens. That's where you grow as a person, right? That's where you occupy your mind doing something that it's not fretting about all the other crazy shit and a bloody war that just started and Donald Trump said something else. No, you're focused on doing something that has some value to transmit that to someone else, to bring some value in their life. And if you shortcut that, and I don't mean, little shortcuts here and there that help you, productivity gains. I mean people who are just saying, oh, no, I just eschew that middle bit, right? When that middle bit is everything. And the chances are what they're producing, if they're doing that, isn't very good, right? And you've got that woman out there, I can't remember who it is, but... she made a lot of headlines in a few weeks ago about the fact she was writing something like 300 romance novels a year, right? And so not only purely using generative AI, right? So not only has she put zero effort into creating those, she hasn't even read them, right? and most novelists, and you'll know this as a script writer, by the time you get a even vaguely functional draft of whatever it is you're writing, you've read it through like 10 times plus, right? Depending on what you're doing, it might be hundreds of times. And so it's like, that's not creativity, right? And it's almost a there's a level of fraud there, creative fraud to me. So strictly speaking, you know, if you can do something and make some money out of it, to an extent, good on you, but at what cost? Right, and are you sort of duping people into reading something that wasn't written by a human? Because culture is created by humans for humans. You can select from a bunch of things that an AI has made, you know, adapt them and then transmit them to someone else. And those things may be of value, but the chances are it's not. And if it is of value, it's probably just a slightly transformed version of what someone else has created already off their own back, right? And this is where we get into the mountain of nuance, right, that is where things get really problematic with people playing around the edges here.
Yeah.
So I remember saying I had more than one point here. What was it? I got so into that point, I have no idea what my other points were.
Yeah. There's a lot, really a lot to unpick there. You know, where are the boundaries here? Really interesting how you talk about, you know, art is in the doing, really, you know, is kind of what you're saying. So that the actually getting down, getting the pencils out, drawing the picture, you know, then takes your mind into that sort of area of focus, you know, getting into flow or not, but certainly, you know, you're spending time producing something, and there's, you know, there's some satisfaction at the end of that, and it's that process in itself that is where a lot of the benefit is. And if you just say, oh yeah, you know, model, please just produce me a picture that was that, then you don't get any of that, and I appreciate that, but if you know, as you said, you're using models as tools to make some of the bits that you find hard or wouldn't do to add in. You know, you would source pictures from wherever, and now you can get a model to create a picture for you. You're still going off and drawing that and painting that. That bit hasn't changed. It's the bit before it that has changed, you know, the input. And you could argue around sort of creating, using creativity in writing. You know, if you're writing a novel, you've got a bunch of characters. I could really see how you could use a model to help build those characters out. Personally, I'd probably use it more on the, you know, you'd build a character and then you'd use it on the checking side of things. Because one of the things I always find when you have multiple characters is you want to make them distinct. And sometimes when you're in the thick of it, you kind of get the voices mixed up. I mean, I don't mean physically the voices, but, you know, what someone might do, because obviously they're all just coming from you as the creator, you know, and I know lots of writers talk about, oh, yeah, you know, and then that character started talking through me and, you know, I knew exactly what they were going to do and they had a life of their own. I've never really had that sort of, that's one of the areas I struggle with. Is that those characters don't really come alive in that manner. I never feel like I'm being, you know, I'm just the puppet and they're controlling me. Perhaps I'm not a good enough writer, I don't know, but it's never really the process I felt. So I've always felt characterization has been a much harder struggle for me. And so I could see where using a tool which is conversational, perhaps, you know, that has a voice, or even in the more sort of more process side, that would say, you know, okay, go and check through the novel so far. Are the actions of this character congruent with their biography? Would they do these sorts of things? You know, I guess the question there is that typical? And then it would come back and say, oh yeah, you know, we've got them doing this. But then they've gone and done that, and actually that's more the reaction of a character over here. That feels like it would be useful. Having, you know, the AI chat back to you as that character, certainly from a, you know, straightforward, something like gender point of view, is quite interesting, because, you know, as a male all the voices in my head are male, you know. So having a female chatting back to me could be quite an interesting way to jolt my own creativity. And that's really where I would see that being used, is as tools to help me think more broadly and to challenge my own thinking. Not sure, as you say, that using it out of the box, oh, it just said this really good dialogue, great, it's just copy that onto the page. I'm sure there's a place for that. It doesn't feel like it's going to be particularly valuable. Apart from anything else, what I've seen when you try and use that sort of stuff is you're getting the average dialogue for the average character for whatever you've given it. Yeah, sure, you can shape it a bit. But still, when you say, oh, okay, let's have a conversation, and you hear it, you know, listen to the, you know, podcasts of AI agents on it, and after a while, you can hear their ticks. You know, you can hear that they're supposedly two different characters, yet they still seem to talk much the same. Well, that's because they're talking in the average way, i.e., they're predicting the next word based on millions of words that they've read, and what's going to be most common. And as a creator, surely you're aiming for a bit better than just average all the time, aren't you?
Well exactly. I have some fucking self-respect, you know. Professional pride. I think that, you know, whether or not people consider that exact approach that you just referred to, I mean, I guess in that way you're getting something you didn't have before, which is someone to you know, quickly sort of verify and idiot check your work, for want of a better term, which you might just use another human to do, right? And it might be the job of an editor and so on. But in the case of someone like you who just wouldn't have had an editor, maybe didn't have people who could easily or quickly check over your work, it's pure utility at that point. It's like, here's your typewriter. Oh, no, here's a word processor, right? I can now work more quickly and have a whole bunch of other things like spell check that I didn't have before. I wouldn't have easily been able to do those jobs. So this is a value add, right? And I think, you know, that when you're thinking about it from that perspective, if, you know, again, ethical issues aside, it seems perfectly valid to me. But you know, but that's exactly that your word processor, your, you know, Microsoft Word is not going to write your shit for you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, these days it sort of might, but like, you know, up until recently, it wasn't going to.
And for me, I've always been, you know, big on tools, be they sort of books or, you know, talks from people about the creative process. You know, and I know that, you know, there are a lot of creative people that go, oh, you know, you can't put a structure around it. Well, I guess with the background that I've come from, you know, my logical brain, I actually find structure really useful. I like to, you know, think about something a character's going to do and come up with different options. And having a tool which gives me some more options, which, to be honest, most of the time I'm going to disregard. But it's nice to know, well, that here's what the average person's going to think. Okay, well, let's go in a different direction. Or actually, no, I just want the average thing to happen here. Or actually, I don't care. You know, I'm not thinking about it. But often coming up with options and choosing one or another. So, yeah.
So the proof is in the pudding here. So I know I bang on about the process is everything, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good process, right? And so this idea that there's a right and a wrong way to do things is nonsensical and wrong, right?
Yeah.
And that if that's how you need to do things to get things done, then that's cool, right? And because ultimately it's the output that counts from that perspective, right? You can do things however you want, but if you want people to look at or read or consume your final product and think that it's good, then your process needs to be good too. It needs to be appropriate. But that process could be, oh, I have a personal troop of performing squirrels that do everything for me, versus, oh, I use this, you know, ultra cutting edge technology, blah, blah, blah. If the output is compelling and creates a valuable culture that people assimilate and love and resonate with and respond to, then the process is kind of irrelevant. But the reason that sort of you know, things like guidelines or best practices exist, is that, you know, those squirrels probably aren't the most efficient way of getting from A to B, and will lead to lower quality results, right? Which is not something any of us really want. So maybe you want to vary that a bit, or try something different. But let's be clear, if the only way you can get what you want and something that's truly valuable is with your performing squirrels, then that's what you should be doing. It sort of doesn't matter whether they're efficient or not, if they get the end point that you want. Right. And this is where we get the difference between someone like Andy Warhol and, you know, like, you know, one of the great masters of painting. Andy Warhol never even entered the room with a lot of the pieces that now sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars. He simply never experienced that artwork. He was not there. He did not make it. Right. And so there's a whole big conversation, you know, we get into Dada and the ready-mades and Marcel Duchamp and stuff like that, and what the nature of art is, right? And the nature of an artwork, in some ways is irrelevant. If it's presented as art, it is art, right? It's up to you as a consumer to decide whether it's good or bad in your mind. And so I think this is where I get, you know, there's no nuance here for me. If the reason you're doing art is for the love of it, and especially if you're like me doing it to help manage your mental health, then the process is the process. The end point is a happy accident, right? And but on the other hand, that doesn't mean to say you don't change your process, you don't make it better, you don't do things, don't add things into it, like generative AI. And for me, the addition of generative AI is not only improving and making my process more pleasurable and its overall utility to me as a human, but it's also making my output, in my mind, better. I think maybe when I show this next batch of artworks, everyone's going to look at it and go, no, that's all shit. And maybe they'll look at it and go, clearly you use generative AI to make this, but I very much doubt it. But that, this is the point for me. It's not all bad, right? And it's not all straight cut. And this is where I was going with that earlier, when I forgot what my second point was. My second point was Luddism, right? And this idea that, the, you know, no generative AI ever is a bit of an odd position to take, right? And I also always feel like I need to put in defense of Luddism, because the Luddites, right, let's be clear, and it is really, really important point here, the Luddites were not anti-technology. The Luddites were all for the technology. What the Luddites had a problem with was that they were losing their jobs to things like weaving technology and factory technology during the Industrial Revolution, but they were getting nothing back, right? So all the proceeds from the improvement of efficiency that cost them their jobs left them starving on the streets. Meanwhile, the factory owners were getting richer and richer and richer, right? They just wanted their fair share of the proceeds, right? That in theory, they'd help create. And so the Luddites went and smashed the factories because they were like, we want a living wage. We want a way to feed our families. And you've literally taken that away from us. And I think that is not at all different from a lot of the concerns that creatives have, right? They're like, we want to smash the machines because the machines have taken our livelihood away. But this is being so heavily conflated with the existence of those machines as evil, right? There are good arguments to suggest that they're evil. And the people that run them might be evil. I don't know. That's not necessarily the point here. The point here is that there is an element of people looking at machines and going, machine bad, full stop, right? Whereas we're all better off because of the weaving machines, because I'm wearing clothes now that didn't cost me lots of money, right? Again, we've already sort of touched on a lot of the nuance around here. But the machines themselves weren't really that bad, right? It was what the machines did to society that was the problem, and society and governments' failure to act accordingly.
And I think tied in with that, going more over into the sort of commercial side, you know, the way we've talked about, you know, process of doing a piece of art is often the process of people doing their jobs. You know, when you're doing more sort of knowledge work, you know, you tend to be solving problems. You tend to be applying a skill you've got to, you know, in a new, a novel way. And I think that in terms of jobs over the last 20, 30 years, you know, with the advent of more and more people in the office and more people having to think for work, if you like, and, you know, you get into a certain way of doing things, you have a process, it seems to work. And now we've got a machine coming along that can do, you know, do parts of it, maybe all of it, makes it more efficient, can do it quicker. So again, it can be helpful, but perhaps if you are too wed to the process you do, you don't see the benefit of it, and it feels more like, well, this is being taken away from me. And again, I think in several hundred years, we won't seem to have changed that much. That, well, and who will be the proceeds? You know, who gets the majority of the proceeds for that? As I'm laid off, or I have to do more and more work for less and less money, and people at the top are going having a wedding for $45 million over one weekend. And, you know, that does seem wrong. Seems like we've not learned much there. And you know, if you're going to lose your livelihood and be out on the street, it doesn't make sense for someone else to be saying, oh, that's great, let's buy another yacht.
Well, that's socialism, Pete. Wash your mouth out with soap.
Yes, indeed.
But that's where we're going on. And we need to not, right? What I think we're discovering with this conversation is that every single route you try and take around it, you start pushing at the edges of society as a whole. You start pushing at the edges of capitalism. You start pushing at the edges of libertarianism but also socialism and politics and geopolitics and economics and ethics and all these things. And it is very much a problem for creatives, but for me, it feels like the creatives and, to a sort of lesser extent, coders and technical techies are the vanguard of the impact that this is having inevitably will continue to have on society. And yes, you might all be looking at the creatives at the moment going, shut your trap, you know, everyone's better off, we've got better staff, you know, someone has to suffer sometime. And actually, the reality of the situation is, pay attention, because you're next, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so, you know, first they came for the creatives, and then they came for, and that side of it, I very much do have sympathy for. Right.
Yeah.
And this is where it pushes into the edges of what I do for a day job. And, you know, we've been in or around AI in some way for a very long time. And this shit changed underneath us. And I find myself now shuffled into a position, we're not that different from any technical professional, that really it's use AI or you're out of a career, right? There's very few jobs in technology now that could meaningfully say I won't use Gen AI. You just simply will be out of a job soon if you don't. You might be out of a job soon anyway, but the quickest way to accelerate that is to not use AI. And so not only do I struggle with the idea of not using it in my creative process, in my day job, I have to use it. And I don't make money out of my art, really, very, very little. So I don't really have the choice of saying, right, now I'm going to be a full-time artist and I'm not going to use AI over there either. Well, I'm in a bit of a rock and a hard place if the stance I want to take is don't use AI, right?
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
You might as well at this point be telling me to don't use water, you know, don't drink liquid. I'm like, I simply will be on the streets if I don't. So, and that is in itself highly problematic and says something about society. In some ways, it is what it is, and that isn't a cop out. Not for people like us.
Hmm. Well, every signal at the moment is it is going to be spreading wider and wider that every job is going to be using some form of AI. And so if you haven't got any hands on it, then you're going to be gone.
I mean, it's unfortunate, right? But I think, look, if... Yeah, no, I'm not going to say what I was going to say. What I want to say is that if you could somehow suck out the ethical issues, you know, this is a technology set has utility. Whether it's the utility that they say it has is a wider question. But, you know, if you can remove all of the ethical and the environmental issues with your magic wand, it's still a valuable tool set, regardless. It absolutely definitely is. Not quite for all the use cases it's being used for. People are using it in really, really unfortunate ways. But the problem is with all of that is that you can't remove the ethics. You can't make that stuff go away. It doesn't matter. You know, it's an almost a meaningless statement, right? This stuff exists because of those ethical problems, right? Those ethical problems were created by the existence of this technology. So there's not even a magic wand solution to this. It's not even if there was a will, you know, this problem would go away. Because what's from a creative perspective, I'm going to make Anthropic and OpenAI pay copyright for all the stuff that they've stolen, even a huge discount, that they're going out of business, right, if you do that. And there's too much invested throughout the sort of capitalist world to allow that to happen. And actually, I do think, many, if not most people, will be somewhat worse off if that happened, because these tools are useful. And so we find ourselves in a bit of a really difficult situation, if at all, you know, the idea of ethics and the environment matters to you. And that's where I find myself. And I find it bothers me deeply on a daily basis. It's almost penance for using it. I feel like I'm self-flagellating here. I should have a whip against my back. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sounds like we've come full circle. I mean, come to a conclusion, so...
Yeah, well, no, actually, and I'll tell you what, here's my closing thoughts. I mean, maybe those were my closing thoughts, but if they weren't explicit enough, I'm not okay with this. You know what I mean? I do realise I'm self-flagellating here, and maybe having recorded this will have made me feel a little bit better, because at least I've vocalised my issues and they're out there, right? And it helped me sort of process my thoughts to a degree. But I'm no better off because of this. I still have needs on multiple fronts to use these tools, and I still feel terrible about doing it. I still sympathise with people that are saying and doing things and acting in ways that are directly contrary to my ability to do that, right? And I find it frustrating and annoying, and I don't have even a vague sense of what a solution for this might look like. And so there are no conclusions here. It's basically been one long therapy session and self-flagellation, and therefore, was it entertaining? was this entertaining is the only question we have left. And we'll leave that to you, exactly. Listeners. The funny thing is, I could keep going. I could talk about this for another hour, but we probably shouldn't, because we've gone over an hour already.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting ramble through the implications of this stuff on our wider society. So,
exactly. Well, and I think we've illustrated that it's not black and white.
No, absolutely.
Highly nuanced. Okay. Well, thank you, listeners, to both podcasts. This will be released on two channels at once, which is a first for me. So,
Well, good luck with that, and machines helping you do it.
Actually, is there any AI used? There is very little AI used in the process of this from here on. actually. Apart from things like transcription, I largely don't use AI anymore because it's not, the AIs around sound editing are not very good. So I don't use them. Okay, good. Right. Thank you for this, Pete. It's been enlightening.
Yes, indeed. And we shall speak again soon.
Yep. See ya.
The confusion matrix.